Appreciate that opening. That was a very good reminder. We're still in 1 Timothy chapter 2. We're going to be starting in verse 9. Before we begin, I want to mention a little bit of a review of the beginning of chapter 2. We were talking about prayer. Paul talks about praying for all men. For kings, for all that are in authority, let me lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. And then he goes on, he mentions why. I think in verse 4 he says, who will have all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. I think that's because God desires all to be saved. You should pray for all men. Something I thought about during the week, I don't think I really talked about last week, was that I think we can learn from here that it's good for us to pray for the salvation of others, family and friends that aren't saved. Because since God desires them to be saved, and that's the reason why we should pray for all men. I think it's good that we pray for the salvation of all those around us that don't know Christ. So we're going to start in verse 9 of chapter 2. Not sure how far we'll get. Probably go into chapter 3 today yet. So I'll just read the rest of the chapter there, starting in verse 9 of chapter 2. In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but which becomes women professing godliness with good works. Let the woman learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing, if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. He starts in verse 9 and says, in like manner also. I think he's comparing to what he said earlier. In verse 8 he says, I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. And he likens it, says, in like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. So what he's going to be going on to say here, I think, is just as important as what he had just said. So I'll be addressing the women. He says that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety. I think the word modest, I think you could define it as not excessive or extreme, not extravagant. That's the definition of the word modest. It talks about modest apparel. I think you can apply it in that way to clothing. It says with shamefacedness and sobriety. Shamefacedness, I looked up the definition. I think it's more bashfulness, I found, or excess of modesty. I think some translations translate that to the word shamefacedness is translated to modesty, with modesty and sobriety. So here, I think the point here, in verse 9 and 10, first he's encouraging that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety, and he says, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly array. And he goes on, and I think this is his main point here in verse 10, he says, but which becomes women professing godliness with good works. I think the emphasis, the goal for women would be to adorn themselves with good works. I think that's the most important thing here. And when he mentions not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, I think he's simply saying that shouldn't be the emphasis. It shouldn't be the emphasis on the outside, drawing attention to yourself, but rather drawing attention to virtue for good works. Does anyone have any thoughts? I'm going to flip to 1 Peter chapter 3, a similar passage of scripture here. He's talking, here he's talking to wives, and he's referring to wives that are married to unbelieving husbands. Starting in verse 3, he says, whose adorning let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and wearing of gold or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. I think here is very similar to the verse in 1 Timothy. He's again emphasizing that the focus should not be on the outward adorning, plaiting the hair, wearing of gold, putting on apparel, not to be drawing attention to yourself, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. You see there the importance of, he says, which is in the sight of God of great price. And he also mentioned that it's not corruptible in contrast to your the outward adorning. It is corruptible, it's fleshly, but the hidden man of the heart, having a meek and quiet spirit, that is eternal. It's of eternal value there. So, do you have any thoughts on this section? Not then, I guess we'll go on verses 11 and 12. He says, let the woman learn silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority with a man, but to be in silence. I think in every place in the Bible when it talks about women being in silence, I think it's referring to teaching, that the woman wouldn't teach or usurp authority or assume authority. Or I think usurp could also mean exercise authority over the man. And a similar verse in 1 Corinthians 14 that I want to flip to. Verses 34 and 35. I think Paul was in chapter 14 talking about the gift of prophecy and of tongues, and then here in the near the end, he's referring to the order of the church, that to be order in the church. Then in verse 34, he says that your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted to them, it's not permitted to them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also says the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shame for women to speak in the church. And there as well, I think it's referring to teaching or assuming authority over the man. You know, any thoughts? Jonathan?
Don't want to take the focus away from 1 Timothy, but the one you just read in 1 Corinthians, I'm curious if you have any thoughts or if anyone has any thoughts on, he says, as the law also says. What does the law say about that?
Do you have any thoughts on that? I've never really known exactly what he's referring to there. I think he's referring to the Mosaic Law. I don't know. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? Do you have any thoughts on that, Jonathan? I remember we've had a discussion, it was quite a while back, in our prayer group about that verse there, and I don't remember if we came to any conclusions about what he's referring to in the law there. So, here in 1 Timothy, he says that it's not the woman's role to teach or assume authority of the man.
I had a verse there. I just lost it here now. But I was thinking perhaps the law there was referring to what God said to Eve after she had eaten of the fruit. Not sure where it is now. Genesis 3:16. And unto the woman he said, "Well, greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception, and in sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." Is that not a law?
Interesting. So you think that he's referring to there that this would be the law, that the man would rule over the woman?
That was my thought.
Okay, interesting. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? Here in in 1 Timothy, when he's referring to the woman's role in the church, he says that it's not to teach. I think I'm going to turn to Titus chapter 2 that shows what the woman's role is. Because in 1 Timothy, I think it mainly emphasizes what her role is not. So Titus chapter 2, verse 3 to 5 says, "The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becomes holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed." So we see here that there's place in the church for the woman to teach. But we can see in 1 Timothy that's not to be in the role of authority, or to teach, to exercise authority over the man. And he goes on here and says, I think he gives his reasons here in verse 13 and 14, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression." Verse 13 mentions Adam was first formed, then Eve. And I think his point there is that God created Eve as a companion to Adam, and not to lead or to be in a place of authority. I think that Paul is making reference to that and applying that to the church. And he goes on, he says in verse 14, "And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression." Does anyone have any thoughts on that? It mentions that Adam was not deceived. I think he's mentioning here that if you read the account in Genesis that Adam was never deceived by the serpent the way Eve was. When God spoke to the woman, should find it, but he says, the woman said, "The serpent beguiled me and I did eat." So you see that the serpent deceived Eve, but when Adam ate, he ate after Eve offered it to him. So I think it's kind of interesting that he's using this as a the reason why women shouldn't be in a place of authority over the man in the church. Does anyone have any thoughts?
I agree with that, but I wonder what your opinion is on the women being in authority other places. Does this just mean church?
That's interesting. I've kind of thought about that in the past. I'm not sure if I have a strong opinion. I'm wondering if anyone else has any thoughts on that. He's asking if the opinion of whether women's authority in other places, not in the church.
I'm still not sure what the question is, but but I would, if maybe my answer will reflect my ignorance of the question, but I would say a woman has authority in the church, but that authority is directed not towards men, but in other areas. For example, older women should teach younger women. There's a measure of authority there. Is that not right? Mm-hmm. You know, with teaching, you know, they look closely at what they're supposed to teach. So there's an element of authority that comes with that teaching, I think, but it's not to be directed towards men. She's supposed to be in submission to man.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think what Mike was asking is, what about women having authority over men in other places, not in the church? Would that be right? Do you have any thoughts? I think we'll go on into verse 15. This is a very interesting verse here, and there's a lot of different opinions on this verse. It says, "Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety." So didn't have any thoughts. Just wondering what you believe about this verse. What he's referring to here. I read Adam Clark and a few other commentators. I had kind of a difficult time understanding exactly what he believes, but he said something. He's referring to Adam and Eve, the promise in Genesis 3:15 that the woman shall be saved through bearing a child, namely the Messiah. But I'm not sure I would agree with that. Any thought?
I've wrestled with that one for a long time as well, and I always stumbled over that word saved, and I wonder if it's not because sometimes when we hear a word, we assume a meaning, and I question whether it actually means saved as in salvation. I think it seems like the context is deception, and then if you look at, so he's speaking about being saved from deception, not as in God saving women because they bear children and allowing them into heaven because they bear children, which is, you could take that just from the way it's written or worded, but that she would be saved, because the whole context here is Adam not being deceived. She was deceived. One of the reasons she was deceived is because she was not in submission to Adam. If she would have listened to Adam and followed his counsel, she probably wouldn't have done this, because he walked into this with both eyes open. He knew what was going on, but he submitted to her, and that allowed this to transpire. And if you look at, if you go back to Genesis, in Genesis 3, when God is giving the sentence on this, in verse 10, "To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow in your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Then to Adam he said, because you heeded the voice of your wife." So the roles and responsibilities were reversed. Adam was heeding the voice of his wife. Mm-hmm. She was going out on her own, which led her into deception. And so is God simply saying that that this is actually a protection for her if she is willing to be under her role or walk in her role in submission to man, that this can be a protection for her not to get into deception?
I would agree with that. I think we have a bit of a, if you go look later in this book, where Paul talks about, I think he's talking about widows here. I think we have a bit of an idea of what Paul is referring to. I think he says, let me see here. verse 13 of chapter 5 in 1 Timothy. It says, "And besides, they learn to be idle, wandering from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also, and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give no occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some are already turned aside after Satan." So here he says that Paul, he desires that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give no occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. I think that's similar to chapter 2. He says, "Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing." And I think I agree with what he said, Jonathan, about being saved. I don't think it's talking about salvation. I think it's talking about being saved from deception. That in childbearing, that the woman would understand her role in that through having children, that the woman would be in her role as a mother. And it's very similar to what he says in chapter 5, that they would guide the house, give no occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Because if you have children, it's a lot harder to wander from house to house and be idle, and what he mentions there, be busybody, speaking things which they ought not. So I think that's kind of what he's referring to there. But then he also mentions, if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. I think that's what I would believe he's referring to here. Do you have any thoughts? I read different commentators on this verse. Someone else goes by the name of Rosenmuller. I've never heard of him before. He believes that a woman, by the proper training of her children, can obtain salvation, and that her appropriate duty is not public teaching, but the training of her family. I wouldn't agree with that. I don't think she's referring to salvation here at all. So, any thoughts on this section here before we go on to chapter 3? If not, I guess we'll continue in chapter 3. Here he goes into qualifications of a bishop. He mentions in verse 1, "This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desires a good work." So, when he mentions the word bishop, what is he referring to here? The role of a bishop. Do you have any thoughts? I looked up this Greek word for bishop in verse 2, and it's found five times in the New Testament. Four times it's translated bishop, and once it's translated as overseer. I think what he's referring to here is an overseer or a pastor or elder of the church. The Webster's definition of bishop is, in the primitive church, a spiritual overseer, an elder or a presbyter, one who had the pastoral care of the church. I think that would be accurate of what he's referring to here. He mentions in verse 1 that he desires a good work. Desiring to be an overseer of the church is a good desire to have, he says. So as we go through these qualifications, one question I would have is, how do we understand these qualifications? Is this a perfect rule to follow, or is it more designed to paint a general picture of what an elder is to be like? Does a bishop or elder have to meet every qualification perfectly in order to be qualified? Do you have any thoughts?
If not, how are you going to choose which one you want to go by and which one you don't?
Okay. Mike?
To rephrase your question, if someone is a complete failure in one of these areas, is he disqualified?
I would think he would be. I guess my question would more be, some of these, they're not black and white as in yes or no, but they're more like, for example, patient. Like, you can be certain levels of have a certain level of patience. You wouldn't necessarily be totally perfect, but you're not very impatient. So my question kind of is, do you have to meet all these perfectly? Or I guess we kind of answered the question. So any other thoughts? Do you have any thoughts on what Mike asked? If you are a failure in one of these areas, does that mean you're disqualified? I would say that you would be, but... I'll assume that you'll agree if you don't say anything. So he goes on here in verse 2, he says, "A bishop must then be blameless." Do you have any thoughts on what he means by blameless? Would you translate it for translate to perfect? Some would think. I think he's referring to my Bible's translation for blameless as above reproach. I think Albert Barnes said the word here is used not to mean that as a necessary qualification for office a bishop should be perfect, but that he should be a man against whom no charge of immorality or of holding false doctrine is alleged. His conduct should be irreprehensible or irreproachable. Undoubtedly, it means that if any charge could be brought against him by implying moral obliquity, he is not fit for the office. He should be a man of irreproachable character for truth, honesty, chastity, and general uprightness. I think I would agree with that. He goes on and says, the husband of one wife. Is Paul saying that an elder has to be married? Is that a qualification for an elder? Does anyone have any thoughts? Mike?
I don't think he is, because from what we know, Paul was not married. And I think he considered himself to be an elder, at least he certainly acted as one.
Okay. Anyone else? George?
I wouldn't think so either, but I heard a thought recently that someone was saying that he should be a one-woman man. If he is married, that he is, it might be also referring to being a one-woman man, like your affections only to your wife, if he is married.
Okay. I would agree with that. For the question of whether he should be married, I think we'll jump ahead a little bit. Some commentators believe that they should be, and they also use the verse in Verse 4, it says, "One that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" Basically, the argument would be that if he's not married, then how can you test whether he can rule his own house? Does anyone have any thoughts? I think for the most part, I don't think he's stating that the qualification is that he should be married. That's never his emphasis. Like in verse 2, he says, the husband of one wife. I think people that would be automatically disqualified is that an elder can't be a woman. A woman can't be the husband of one wife. So it's clear that it's very obvious. But there, we know that there's people that don't believe that. And an elder can't be a polygamist. And I don't think an elder could be divorced and remarried. I think those are all... Those people would all be disqualified automatically. He goes on and says, vigilant. I think the word vigilant basically means watchful, I think. Elders must watch over the church, so the qualification of an elder, they have to be vigilant. It's a definition of a definition here. It says, watchful, circumspect, attentive, to discover and avoid danger, or to provide for safety. I think an elder should be watchful over the church, but also watchful over himself, that they would they'd know, that they'd be aware of any temptation and things like that. He goes on, he says, sober. I think that would be, you should have self-control, being of a sound mind, and have good behavior. Do you have had any thoughts on any of these so far? Derek?
I guess I'm still thinking of verse 1 there, where Paul is telling Timothy, this is a true saying. Excuse me. This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. And so often in the past, people have, you know, there's a, it can be a negative thing toward leadership, or even someone that desires that. It says he desireth a good work. So Paul was telling Timothy, there's going to be people that are going to see that there's a need for people to lead the church. And then he says, this is how you look at this. Then, you know, there's going to be men desiring this good work in all. You know, they see the need. There needs to be leadership. And then the beauty of it all is that now we can see if these people that are leading out, or, you know, when you choose from among you, that you can look at all these beautiful things. And that's how, I mean, it's not a negative thing. It's a good work.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think when you look at this passage here, I think there's more than one way we can apply it. The one way, the most obvious way, is to apply it to for qualifications of a bishop. But then also, these are all good things. These are all good things that we should all strive for. I think what you mentioned there about desiring the office of a bishop, it's a good work. It reminds me of different stories I've heard about people in the Old Colony Church, that they were depressed when they were ordained as a preacher in the church. And I've heard stories of some people that they, when they were younger, they committed certain sins so that they're automatically disqualified. So I think it's very good to have elders that desire the work, and that it is a good work, and it's a good desire to have. When you look at of good behavior, where are we here? I think some people translate that as a gentleman, orderly, decent, grave, just simply being of good behavior, not being, I don't know, silly, or someone that is mature, I think. So the emphasis there is. It's given to hospitality. It's pretty straightforward. Someone that loves to host strangers, apt to teach or able to teach. I think this is clear that an elder must be able to teach the flock, teach the word of God, and to be able to lead in that way. You go to verse 3, it says, not given to wine. I think it's pretty straightforward there. Not clearly not addicted to alcohol, or shouldn't be given. I think the word given there would be addicted. No striker. I think that's not quarrelsome. I read an interesting story about a bishop. It was, I've never heard of this bishop before, Bishop Bonner. I forget where I read this, but I have it right here. It's pretty kind of interesting. He says, it is said of Bishop Bonner of infamous memory that when examining the poor Protestants whom he termed heretics, when worsted by them in argument, he was used to smite them with his fist and sometimes scourge and whip them. But though he was a most ignorant and consummate savage, yet from such a scripture as this, he might have seen the necessity of surrendering his mitre. So I think that's kind of interesting. It's clear that he would automatically be disqualified. He goes on, he says, not greedy of filthy lucre. I think he's someone that is not a lover of money, I think. I read someone said there is nothing that more certainly paralyzes the usefulness of a minister of the gospel than the love of money. It's but patient. I think that's pretty straightforward. Not a brawler. A brawler would be someone that's contentious. Not contentious, but quiet and peaceable, I think. And not covetous. Anyone have any thoughts? He goes on here, says, one that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man knows not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? I think it is an interesting question to ask does this mean that an elder would have to be a married man so that we can see if he can rule his own house? So we don't have any thoughts on that. I think what we can see from this is that an elder will have to be an example in how to rule his house. And then also, it's very clear that if a man can't rule his own house, then he's definitely not qualified to take care of the church of God. Any thoughts? He goes on here in verse 6, he says, not a novice. I think that basically means a recent convert. It says, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. I think here we see that someone that is a recent convert, first of all, there's little opportunity to test his faith, and then even less evidence of whether he's qualified to lead the church. He mentions here, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. And I think that's very, a lot more likely for someone that is not mature in the faith yet. So you don't have any thoughts on that? Or anything we've spoken of so far? Up here, Clarence?
I have a question concerning verse 1. All the qualifications that we've covered here, and then verse 1, it says, it talks about desire. A man that desires the office of a bishop, he desireth the good work. How do we define that word desire? How would we qualify that word desire with a person outside of the element of pride or power seeking or such like? I'm not sure I can answer that. I was just wondering if anybody else would have thoughts on that.
Do you have any thoughts?
Jesus talked about Gentile leadership. I think there's a lot of Gentile leadership in that it is a place of position and so on. But Jesus said that his disciples are they're supposed to be as one that serves. And I don't think there's much room for pride or position in something like that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that clearly it has to be someone that... Do you have any thoughts?
I was just thinking if that's the case, then he's probably not grading very well on the other points that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. I think different ones of those would talk about that into play there if he's just looking for a position, that he would probably be unfaithful in some of the other ones here.
I would agree with that. A mic up here.
Maybe this person has felt God's call, and just like other people feel God's call to mission work or to service in some other area. This person may have felt God's call and wants to be obedient to it. Just because he desires it doesn't mean he puts a sign at the end of his lane saying, I want to be the bishop. Mm-hmm. But it could even be something in his heart that he just wants to be obedient to what he knows God has asked him to do.
And I think for someone that desires the office of a bishop, I think, first of all, we'd have to know them very well before, we have to know them in order that we could test them, that if they would meet these qualifications. And so if there is someone that simply wants that position of power and that pride, I think we would, if we know them well enough, I think we would be able to see that. And like George was saying, they wouldn't meet some of the other qualifications here. Any other thoughts? You go to verse 7, he says, moreover, he must have a good report of them which are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. I think when he says them which are outside, he's talking about them which are outside the church. Does anyone have any thoughts on this? Or how would we be able to judge this? Would it be referring to people outside of the church that are not Christians, or would it just be just in general? Does anyone have any thoughts? This is one of the qualifications that I always had more struggle with understanding. Clarence?
Are you referring to the first part of verse 7?
Yeah.
Yeah. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without. I've seen that men that would meet many of these qualifications that we've studied here this morning, other people that non-Christians, non-church members, so forth, we would call them the people of the world. Many of them would, once they get to know individuals like this, they still have a certain amount of respect for them just because of these qualities that that rule in their life, carry a certain amount of weight to them as far as personality and character are concerned. And that out in the world still bears a certain amount of respect to these kind of people, from people that they might be even completely in the opposite of this.
Yeah.
I've seen that. I've seen in business settings where a person that is willing to set himself forth as being totally irrevocably honest in all things, he speaks the truth, he means the truth. The shake of a hand, the handshake, carries as much weight as a legal document with a bunch of signatures on them. These kind of things still carry some weight amongst people that are non-Christians outside of the scriptural basis. I can't necessarily say why. I've experienced it. I've seen it, and mm-hmm. it's there.
I would agree with that. Something I've thought about was, especially in the day and age that we live in, where if you speak against homosexuality, for example, that you're basically despised by the world. And I thought about it in this context, that if a man known, that is probably well known in the world, they would be despised because of their view on homosexuality. I don't think that would disqualify him at all. I think this has to be, like, if someone that has a good report for things that are good, if you're despised for something that is right, I don't think that would disqualify him at all. And that's kind of like where I think you have to have a balance of referring to, if you have a good report of people that aren't Christians that don't hold your values. And I think Clarence did a good job of describing that. A lot of these things they'd still hold true that are good and right. I think that should be someone that's well respected. or has a good reputation, I think. And he mentions here, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. And he says, fall into reproach, I think that'd be like someone that doesn't have a good report of people outside of the church. They could fall into reproach that they would be accused of certain things, or I don't know. I think it could be an occasion for the devil to slander you, I think, in certain ways. Didn't have any thoughts. I think we'll wrap it up here. Didn't have any thoughts before we close. All right, well, God bless you.